So what, is there anything comparable to that among the present, say, astronomers? Or is this...
You mean in terms of...
Yes. You say these are mystical...
Well,
character.
For example, in cosmology, there are some theories in terms of... And these are very sound theories based on mathematical rigor. For example, when you have a body undergoing gravitational collapse, producing a mathematical singularity, well, the applied mathematicians here, theoretical physicists, have worked their way out of this into different interpretations. And one interpretation, which is a topological interpretation, involves matter closing in on itself. Nothing leaks out. It's like a bottle, and the energy can't even escape from the system because it just collapses due to the intense gravitational field. So it's got to go someplace. Either it goes out of existence from our visible universe in terms of what we can see. But there's an equally startling aspect here, was one of the logical conclusions based on some of these theories was that the matter could spring up like a spring gushing forth in another part of our universe, or topologically connected to another universe which may be closed. So we may be living in a holy universe, essentially.
It's sort of like waking up from a dream state. Going from one state.
But this kind of thing enlarges our view. Each concept starts shattering the older concepts, and the older concepts crumble. They're getting more.
What I meant was, do you know anything about the cosmologists or the mathematicians or physicists as persons? And do they regard this in a purely theoretical way or not? Because people like Newton and of the century before him were very much involved in mystical things. It doesn't seem to appear in the history of science, having any significance.
Well, Einstein had a lot of mystical attributes, and Schrodinger had a lot of mystical attributes, and also all the theoretical people that I know, they have a leaning towards this quest. It's an unknown, it's a driving force. Yeah, and they realize that science just doesn't give all the answers. It's just overwhelming. They're pressing on, and of course
they may be more open-minded than philosophers. I mean, than so-called philosophers.
Our psychologists are going materialistic and positivistic and so on. Physicists are becoming the mystics of it.
Part of the physics now is there are some people there's one person who's postulated particles faster than light, which gained...
I ran across that in Scientific American.
Well, they gain mass as they slow down to the speed of light. And it's mathematically sound. And all I have to do is experimentally verify it and try to at least...
I ran across a reference to that. It's collapsing a star. Even used the term a hole in space.
Yeah.
Would that be an implosion?
Well, that's a good way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. But there's also another thing that I was thinking about the other day, that gravitational collapse, which is according to Einstein, very strong. I mean, that's where it comes from, Einstein's that if you take a particle and keep accelerating it faster and faster and faster, let's say an electron, it will eventually gain mass, Einstein's equation, and also it shrinks in size in the direction of the
travel.
And it will eventually reach a point in which it will have gravitational collapse if it gains a sufficient amount of energy. And it will, for all practical purposes, disappear from our universe, at least from our as an observer. And there's all sorts of things like this that can be applied to it. I know physicists haven't, as far as I'm concerned, they haven't looked into that yet. there's energies to that are very great.
This makes Alice in Wonderland seem like ordinary common sense.
Yeah, Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
But the sun is kind of today, like, it is very mystical. That's I think more of the empiricists have a tendency to be skeptical, extremely skeptical, and they just do the plotting work, and they don't do the fantasizing. The fantasizing is really a theoretical fear, and that's where fantasy comes. But it's fantasy is a prelude to reality in terms of factual consistency.
You know,
somebody's fantasy is closer to the truth than somewhere else's.
Jung is a very high place to create a fantasy in the psychology.
Well, science fiction of today is almost a physics, really. A lot of the science fiction, you know, is really a foreground.
It has been.
Yeah.
30 years ago, I read about the atom bomb, you know, or more than that, in science fiction.
You begin to wonder whether or not you get into an idealistic kind of thing where ideas are transformed into the hardcore reality.
Well, as Jung says, a mere idea produced the atomic explosion.
Yeah, or what's the probability of a television set evolving, you know, just from nothing, whatever, on the basis of probabilistic constituents of the atom?
You know, thinking that, you know, the transition from the sleeping state to awakening state is a sort of inversion. And the other way around.
Have you ever been able to watch yourself go to sleep?
No, just sort of going back and forth while waking up.
Yeah, waking up. You can get it.
Aurobindo stresses that as an excellent exercise for developing, remaining conscious as you go to sleep,
trying to remain.
And the only thing I've been able to do in that line is you this free flow and imagery just sort of passes. You don't hold on to anything. Eventually, a dream starts coming up, but you're still awake, and you can slip into a dream consciously that way. It takes a little practice, but anybody can do it. You can get it to where you can solid, then you lose, not consciousness, but you lose your place. You don't know that you forget that you're dreaming, and you get involved in the dream.
Yes, you start in with a dream where you know you're dreaming.
Right.
And then gradually you drop out of the memory of all of your past life, and you're back in just ordinary dreamer.
Oh, I forgot something. You asked me that question, and I would say yes in one sense, but it's not like a dream in the ordinary sense, because the dream in the ordinary sense is like waking. I mean, you were involved, you were seeing something from a certain point of view. But sort of like watching pictures, you know, you're detached as you are in a moving picture theater. You're perfectly aware of being in bed, but you see pictures, strange scenes sort of floating about. And that's what I said. You might enter into one of these pictures, so to speak, and that would be being in a dream. But just, you know, being aware of it.
I remember when
you're really awake, in my sense, you realize where you are.
I remember once lying in bed, going to sleep. I was thinking about traveling over a certain road. It was in Arizona. As the Mormon, in the days of the Mormon Dirk Ray and Lee's Ferry, and thinking about passing over, I fell to sleep, and there I found myself actually driving the road. But another factor came in I hadn't foreseen. That's a very crooked road, I don't imagine.
I mean, you were you found you were actually driving in your seat, but you woke up.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and then I was actually driving, and I fell asleep doing the thing I was thinking about, but actually doing it in the dream. And a fellow that I hadn't foreseen came into the picture. Now, this is a terrific road, very narrow, very windy. It's no longer used because they have a bridge across instead of East Ferry. But many drivers lost their nerve going over that road. And I came around and turned, I was going up. And then up here came another car, a magnificent racing car, coming at full speed, and Mephistopheles was at the wheel. ultimately, when we collided, I woke up. But he was a magnificent driver. An impossible road at a tremendous speed. I mean, now. Oh, I admired him. So skillful. I hadn't figured on it.
I remember having a dream once where I was standing behind myself and a little above myself, looking at myself. That was many, many years ago. I think that's one of the first things that got me to thinking about metaphysics.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite possible.
I was trying to decide which one of those was I. Was I two people?
Well, I think those have two that kept, you know, think of it as entering into the dream or not, that you can see thoughts approach. I mean, you get to the through discipline and all, get to the point where you can see them approaching, and then you can accept or reject them.
I've had some of that experience along that line. That because sometimes I would see thoughts that I didn't want to see coming, but I wasn't able to reject or accept them. I would just have to take them as they came, and I was just out of phase with it. Time. I don't know what something was happening. And I was foreseeing about a few jumps in the future, maybe 2 or 3 minutes. It was just slightly out of phase with time. This is the way I felt I was experiencing. And I'd see something and all of a sudden, bam, it would happen. It was just keep doing this. And I was seeing thought processes. I was seeing what was going through people's heads and then their reaction and their emotional effect on the body and everything else. And I was sort of startled by the whole thing. I didn't know what it meant, but
the voice of the silence was suffer not even their shadow to approach. You're starting that thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, when a person first hears a statement like that, seeing thoughts approaching, you know, it's represented pictorially, and of course,
it
doesn't mean that
it's
at all.
It's a
feeling. Yeah. This is, you know, if it develops, it would be a sudden thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to describe that. I see someone do something, and I know that, let's say someone did something, I see it, a physical and I see the effect that this action has on the person before they even come into to see this other person. And so I can see the interaction before it even happens. And then I see the interaction. Well, at that time, the interaction I saw was an unpleasant one, so I didn't care, and it made me sick. Almost, physically, I feel pain when I come into this housing. And when I saw this clash, it was almost like the potential between in terms of lightning. It's almost like a charge that builds up between the present and the future. It was then it just came together. It happened.
Interesting.
Unusual.
Hey, I understand Professor Humphreys takes a rather pejorative attitude toward mysticism, if I hear reports right.
Well, I suppose I'm not sure about that, really.
Well,
I've been trying to say that.
I think he ought to have been here tonight.
I wish he'd come. Yes, he's babysitting. He's rather hard to get babysitters sometimes. His wife has an engagement of some standing.
He felt that he had a major philosophical breakthrough a few weeks ago, and he was going to deliver the first real lecture in philosophy since Thales. And whereas Thales' hypothesis was this was in real life, you know, in the class.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Whereas Thales had a hypothesis that all was water. His hypothesis was that all was strawberry jam. Because everywhere in his house when he looked, there was strawberry jam.
He's having some fun.
But, well, that was just off to the side, actually. I think he had some... ideas.
Well, he has some interesting theories of it about Kant, for he was saying the other day that he thought that Kant felt that there was a real succession in the world, but not time. That's what I mean. It's easy, but there are a number of people at present, and I think Sellers, I don't mean the older Sellers, but there's his son who's quite famous now as a philosopher.
A real succession, but not...
sort of realistic interpretation of Kant.
A real succession, but not time.
No, I suppose you might say, well, in mathematics there are successions, but they're not temporal.
There's no succession.
Mm-hmm.
It's an instant at rest. It's just like there's a point and there's no next point.
Yeah.
Every moment is at rest. And this is a mathematically sound concept in terms of what we would call time in mathematics. The instants of time are just like mathematical points. There's no flow, it's just instants of rest. Like a movie. Right, and that's all it is.
No, Derrickson would say that was spatialized time.
Right. There isn't anything theory, I understand, that follows that pattern. The universe is...
take out real one.
Exists stationarily from an instant and disappears in return. Well, how about Weir Strauss? A conception which parallels that. He's a mathematician. Namely that our time is being merely in different points in space at different points in time without any motion between. It's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, well, this theoretical nuclear physicist I know said something to me that was interesting. He said that we could be, in fourth dimensional sense, we could be going backwards, living backwards, and we wouldn't know it. Because each distinct point in space-time is a distinct point, and you would not know whether you're going forwards or backwards. I don't know, I don't have enough command to really question that.
Well, I think that Derek's going to have a point there, that I don't mean that you can't think of something timeless, but in, for instance, well, you have states of the universe, and you could imagine each one somehow depicted on a playing card.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say this is an unusual deck of cards if you're tuning into an infinite number of others. Well, imagine them spread out in some sense.
Yes.
Then you say that the time, in the sense of change, has disappeared. It's, and you know, if your formulas can apply to something that is not in real succession, as well as to something that you might say is succession, in a non-mathematical sense, that then they really don't give you the essence of change. They don't give you the essence, even the essence of duration. And that's why you can distinguish between the structure of time and or of complicated changes in time within a physical theory and the actual process.
I think the concept of duration could be used to, in contrast to the concept of time, duration being that in which nothing is lost, as our ordinary time separates us from the future and the past, not the present. As it goes into the past, it's lost. And I spoke about this inverse consciousness, which impresses you with a sense of depth, of duration, of vast profundity. The word hori seems to apply. But there's very little that you can say about it. Only nothing is lost there. In duration, nothing is lost, always recovered. In time, the opportunity of this moment, which is not used, is lost forever. That's the reason the Sphincter calls it tragic.
I see.
And I was thinking there's a possibility is that mentioning duration brought up, that you could conceive of a sort of whole of time, and if you like, it works itself out, or to use that expression, karma, and the karma is worked out, the time is worked out, and then, if you like, it's as if, in a sense, it hadn't been a process of change. Completion, which is true with it.
I worked up an imaginary concept one time, which I hope wasn't true, but Irma says it is. You may run across the conception of the Akasha as being a record of everything that ever has taken place, and perhaps even of that which will take place. And it is possible to superimpose the consciousness of another state upon your own state so you experience it with full force. I did a little experimenting with that. Like, for instance, I had a problem with a person who was an alcoholic, and I couldn't understand why he was that way. Penetrated into the problem over quite some time, and finally induced a superposition of the state of consciousness of a very advanced alcoholic. And in that state, I felt as though my own, his enormous craving, possession by it, so strong that I would go for the drink of liquor, even though death was the price I'd pay beyond, or I'd have to kill to get there. That was the intensity that I felt. Now, there were two, a division of the sense of self. One as a witness that knew that this was a superposition, and then a participating self that went through the whole experience as with the full intensity of feeling and craving, as though it were your own. Well, now, it appears that this that is called the Akashic Cracker is not something like a written record or a tape or anything of that sort, but it is a reliving, actually, with all the felt quality as well as the other qualities, as though it were your present experience. So this is a story or fairy tale that I invented. There was a chap who had entered into the Savikalpa Samadhi, which is the samadhi in which you deal with phenomena, and had learned how to project himself back into a previous incarnation. So he threw himself into this state, and he projected himself back to some certain incarnation, and he found himself an infant in his mother's arms. From that he went on living the whole life with all of the feelings and all of the experiences as though they were his own. Only there were these two phases, the witness self that knew this was living another life, living over a life, and knew that it was his, not his present life in apparent real time. I'll use the word apparent for a reason that'll appear later. Well, he came up to young man who ultimately married, of course, killed his part in life. Along came his catastrophe that was literally beyond words, so I cannot describe it. However, the result of the catastrophe was that he lost his wife and family, and there was a great gap when, after a while, he woke up in an institution where the white-coated attendants are. He gradually gained control of himself, was released from the institution, took up another life afterward, married again, and lived, say, up to about 94. I mean, now this person is going through all of these experiences. He died, went through the bardo, finally over into what we call the Devakonic interlude, where he projected, of course, his environment. And he had a nice rustic residence in a forest with a grass meadow in front of him, and a lovely stream running through, and the wild creatures were all very gentle. And here his first wife was, and he had his children there at any age he wanted them. Very delightful. But he also could flip, and there he had a castle down on a cliff over the sea. And his other wife and his other family were there. And he could flip back and forth between them. He spent thousands of years in objective time there. And then he finally started to go to sleep more and more, and then presently he was drawn to a newly married couple, and he woke up and found himself back in his apparent real time, coming out of a state of samadhi in which he had been 1.5 hour. Meanwhile, going through this experience of 94-year-old life, 1,000 years in India. Well, he decided that was a little bit too strenuous for him. He'd be a little careful about delving into the back halfway. One thing to look at things, another thing to feel. But presently, one day, he flipped again. Found himself just again waking up from a samadhi, from a state of samadhi, in which he had been for 15 minutes. Now, he thought he had been in real time, but it was only apparent real time. But in his final state, what assurance has he that he is now in real time? is against doing that? Am I perhaps just living over and over again in an endless treadmill lives which I've lived in the past? And if that is the nature of samsara from which we wish to attain freedom? I said, I hope that isn't true.
Certainly, yeah, I've had some experience that come pretty close to that. I don't particularly care for that. That's too close to reality, too.
There is
solution
to such a squirrel cage sort of thing?
That's what it would be.
Yes. Well, that doesn't have one.
That would fit samsara's disgust for samsara, Shankar's disgust for samsara.
There's an episode from a story of a man who is in a cavern deep underground. He takes a drink of a certain liquid and wakes up on the surface of the earth. And how is that now?
Well, he was walking along in a desert, met a camel train, as I remember. He got some provisions and so on. But presently, cold wind began to come. It had been pretty hot. He went toward the cold wind, but it got colder and colder. Finally, he turned the other way, tried to get away from the cold. But he caught up with him. He was a nice age. And he was caught in the ice. And he persisted, just as an immovable consciousness in that ice, until the ice set, until a warm cycle came, and the ice vanished.
Which would be a matter
of thousands of years. He'd taken a drink of this liquid that had grown in a kind of a mushroom down there. And there was a guide with him. Then he woke up as he came out of the ice age, and he found himself kneeling before his guide. And he started to belabor the guide for the truth, this terrible experience he'd been through. And the guide said, "You've only just now dropped to your knees since you took it. It's only been a couple of seconds." Now that leads to the suggestion that time might be more than one dimensional. You spoke about going sideways through time.
That's not very pleasant. Well, it can be, but it has a lot of moral problems that I haven't learned how to.
Ostinsky talks about his pet theory was that the moment of death is also the moment of birth, and you keep living the same life over and over and over again.
That's the most dreaded birth thing that I've ever run into, and I saw that one too. That's not very pleasant. I just saw an infinity of rebirth that just totally nauseating.
What Dr. Wolf suggested was, is that like Chuang Tzu's butterfly dream? Chuang Tzu's butterfly dream, you know. He dreamt he was a butterfly, and then he woke up, he said, "Perhaps I'm a butterfly dreaming. I'm awake." You know, dreaming what is now, which way is it?
But is the solution to break out of time? Into another.
It is to break out of bondage, not out of. Well, why must we assume that there is a stoppage of movement in some sense? It seems to me that, in the Gita, for instance, that one rises above the bonds of action. You might rise above the bonds of action, there might still be a lot of motion, but it wouldn't be motion that involves bondage.
No. Well, now there is a consciousness in which you rise out of the relativity of time, and at once your or at the beginning and the end of the midpoint. And it is neither motion nor the absence of motion. It's one of those paradoxical things that we can't grasp in our concept.
That point, which you might call beyond time, which has another set of rules and beyond symbols, where how long you stay there, it really has no meaning because you can go back into time, anytime, anywhere, any place, any configuration, and someone has said that you might call it nirvana is just a resting point on the highway to eternity. Highway, and we're occupying time every now and then, and as one grows in terms of spiral, E, whatever you want to call it, mathematical symbols, a growth, what we call growth, evolution. This gives you growth, I think, if we want to call it growth, gives you a choice in conditions that you want to impose upon yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But why anyone would want to impose upon himself a loop? Let's say you're going along in time. Let's say a successive thing. If you recycle, go back into a past life, that's like a loop.
Mm.
And you can go around that loop until you jump out of it again into something else.
Mm.
But that loop, you can go through that loop a number of times. But why anybody would want to go through a loop, realizing he's going into a loop.
Mm.
But some may do that. If you want to look at it that way, that perspective. So
you might get caught in it involuntarily.
Yeah.
It's a good thing we don't have some of the more materialistic psychologists in this room.
This life sounds more like a dream.
We all end up in an institution with the
white. With the white girls, yeah.
Just thinking in philosophy these days, there's more, you know, one is being rather way out. And to say that there is a difference between subject and object. In one sense, people would like to say it's all object. And that would be a form of positivist or behaviorist. The idea of subjectivity seems to be something that people regard as most outlandish now. But what objectivity would be apart from subjectivity, I don't know.
Alan Watts says, I don't know if you've read much of him, but he would rather call a chair, instead of calling a chair, call it chairing, lamping, rugging. In other words, it gets rid of this objective subject kind of duality that we impose upon things. And he's sort of developed a language of being, kind of a language of being or action with no object and subject.
His word is treeness.
Treeness or treeing. A tree, what is a tree? It's treeing. It's, doing it all the relative terms that we use in everyday life and which are part of our being. The analysis of these things and what problems it gets us into by cleaving. The moment we cleave it here, we've separated. We've always made this lesser or this greater. in mathematics that do the same thing. But it's part of life and reality. This is all that's all happening. And, it's a rather interesting subject that he goes into rather deep. It's very interesting.
Who is this?
Alan Watts. He's written a number of books on Buddhism.
Well, Zen.
Zen Buddhism. But also the whole. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what makes the difference between this world of reality and Nirvana?
Well, of course, without all of our conceptions are based upon the principle of dualism, contrast,
yeah. And it's a very interesting subject in itself, on a pure level, philosophical level. It's very interesting. And Hegel goes into that to some degree. I guess he was sort of a master of that too.
Well, that's why I asked about what you meant by how the opposite of approach.
Yeah.
And Hegel has his method of getting
there. Yeah, he has his method. And,
and someone like Sartre has too.
Uh-huh.
I've been very much impressed by him. I had not read Being Nothingness until this year. And one sometimes has the feeling that you almost see, the origin of samsara. When you're reading him,
I don't know. I usually go through cycles or phases where I swing from a strongly materialistic, very very ultra skeptical position to one of extreme optimism and idealistic position, and I look at the whole thing as heads and tails.
But with your experiences, what do you mean by a skeptical position?
Well, when I get into a skeptical position, I don't believe anything.
You don't believe what you remember?
I don't believe any of that. I don't believe any of my own experiences. I don't believe anything as such. I become, in other words, the universe takes on a flat gray character of no purpose, no meaning. And
is that really skepticism or despair?
It's almost, there's really despair, really, that's what it is. And all you do is reach the bottom of the pit, and which is just an annihilation or nothing.
What is that, Camus would call it, the absurd or
scientism? Yeah, when you echo or bounce against this thing, I don't know the terms to use it. To apply to it,
well, I think the ancient Greeks skeptics were really, they could really be unshakable because they didn't assert anything.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's the condition of being absurd. You see.
Mm-hmm.
Every time when something comes up, is it true, is it false? Then you suspend your judgment.
Yeah.
And you let other people make the assertions.
Yeah.
You may trap them that way, but you don't yourself enter into this.
Yeah, you're correct. Because you're not entering into it. Yeah.
It's sort of interesting imitation of being liberated in that
skepticism.
Yeah. I think that's a bit cowardly.
Putting them all together is the interesting thing.
In that sense, the ancient Greek, who will not make an assertion, he's a sort of mystic. There's a connection between
them.
Because, the one who makes an assertion has to negate, he has to exclude, the contradictory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He either negates or affirms.
Mm-hmm. So it's a sort of projection on the plane of intellect. What is beyond that? So you see, you're really not in those moments as non-mystical as you think.
It's like a loop going around and going around. I pay less attention to in other words, I'm getting to the point where I do not believe or disbelieve. It makes no difference one way or the other. It's just a part of the same as the red is a part of the color of the rose in that sense.
But, you know, Dr. brought up the question of authenticity. You know, is it possible to be fooled by experiences like that? I mean, this has been sketchy,
yeah, well,
that you've introduced
there. Yeah,
I'm sure
you can be, yeah.
What, William James has this great variety of religious experiences, you see, and he says, his particular method of deciding between them is a sort of pragmatic moral method, that is to say, the great mystics are those whose experiences have utterly changed their lives, and Bergson says somewhat the same thing, only I think that he doesn't understand the Indians either. I mean, he's influenced by Schweitzer's interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Do we have to decide is another question, which really gets back to that other point again.
Do we have to decide?
Do we have to decide? Is that having the
are we free?
The having to decide is an attachment. As well as not having to decide.
Well, is that, I know, but is that, you know, a sort of attitude or view you have of decision, or is it that you are really in the throes of decision? You know, I think you can...
I think
you can fool yourself about decision.
Well, it's like a magnetic field. You align when it comes together, it aligns up the certain configuration, the wave patterns of the atoms, such that this happens. And the alignment occurs when you put these things together. And then you take it away, the alignment may still retain itself. You heat it up and it disappears. And the heating might be an experience which sort of dissipates this.
You know, I mean, here is a place where philosophy perhaps has some value. Because, you know, you're completely objectifying the situation as if you're treating yourself as an object. And, you know, it seems to me that you can put this in a philosophical perspective. Can you really treat yourself as an object? I don't know anyone who can, you know, who can treat himself as an object. You might treat somebody else as an object.
You could treat your organism.
You could treat your organism as an object.
You mean treating
yourself.
Yourself as you call yourself,
yes,
within yourself, your consciousness, or your observing point.
You can treat all of your functions, your thoughts, your feelings, and so forth, as an object. But there's something that treats them as an object.
Yeah.
And I am that.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, going through this multitude of psychic conditions that you have and so on, if they went on of themselves, you'd get pretty tired of them. You couldn't stop them.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently, according to Kaiserling, Ceylon, he found that same thing happening to him. Apparently, in that climate where you have jungle-like growth, the psychic light goes on of itself till you become miserably tired of it. And one hope is to get away from this everlasting process going on and on and on. And I could imagine what you've been describing, if it kept on at you without your being able to stop it or not, that it become very wearisome after a while.
Yeah.
And you would almost, might even welcome annihilation to get away from. Well, Kaiserling says he found among the Buddhists in Ceylon that there actually was an attitude of that kind, that they sought annihilation in order to get away from this endless psychic involvement, a process that didn't mean anything.
meaning is another thing. It depends on what you want to make of it. I'm of such a nature. I look at myself as a chameleon, more or less. Really. I take shape and form, and I have certain patterns that they echo of the people that I'm with. And my meaning and intent takes on various shapes, and also the purpose and function within myself takes on various shapes, depending upon where I am and what environment I'm in. But as this keeps going on and on, I'm finding that in the midst of all this happening, whatever's going on mentally, physically, there are certain things, this unchangeable character, that I'm beginning to glimpse. And that's the thing, the resting point.
Seek the permanent and the impermanent. Impermanent to command the shankar. And there you get released. Bruce, will you get the copy ready? Could you give it to Dr. right now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Be very happy to have it.
Thank you.
Be about a week.
Well, we see each other.
And I'm very grateful to him for starting this ball rolling. I didn't know whether it would ever get published. It might get around sufficiently so some publisher would pick it up. I'd say a manuscript will never pay its way.
How about a university press?
That is possible. They sometimes have one, possibly a foundation, the right person.
Maybe some university uses it as a textbook.
I think it might do something that students got to wrestling with the ideas, and it doesn't matter whether they accept or reject, just so that they deal with them. I think it'll do something to them.
We made 100 copies. We've got about 40 of them sold and paid for now.
Be congratulated. Well, I don't think they knew how long it was, what a job it was. They would have taken it up.
We thought we'd have it out in about a week.
Two weeks.
It's about 200,000 words.
2.5 months,
I guess. I kind of think you had gone ahead with it even if they knew how long it took.
It was fun. It was really fun, every minute of it.
Now, did you have a chance to get any ideas out of it while you're dealing with it, or were you just dealing with words?
Here and there I got some ideas. But I haven't read it straight through. I've only read the part that I've
read
got.
Read the meaning. So you're dealing with the externalities of the problem. Like a proofreader, this is the dumbest kind of reading. I can't do it. I get caught up with the ideas.
I know some proofreader. Is it about 700 pages?
No, we condensed it. Well, by condensing and typing on the pencil, to about 400.
372.
I have a master copy that is in the form the publisher wants, with broad margins, and that's 900 pages. But they put it down to the narrow margins of single space, reduced it more than two to one.
There's the other project, is it not the theosophy paper?
Mm-hmm.